Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast from the Early Morning Late Show. It's 4 minutes after the hour, and this is the final broadcast of 2017 of the Early Morning Late Show, and thank you for welcoming me into your home and your car and your time in the morning, because that is such sacred time as you prepare for your day and try to get yourself right to go out and face the day with courage and strength. And I just pray every day for you as I'm driving to work, and I also pray that God is growing in your life, and you have the boldness and courage to share your faith with others. It's a big deal. I love Isaiah 41:10. I'm going to quote that one more time in 2017 and probably again in 2018. But it says, "So do not fear, for I am with you. Do not be dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you and help you. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand." And it looks like it's going to be a very chilly day in the upper Midwest, so dress warm. I had a great conversation with Colin Hanson from the Gospel Coalition. What an interesting guy. We talked about the highlights of 2017. That is straight ahead. We'll take a short break and then connect with Colin in just a minute. It is 5 minutes after the hour. Be back in a minute. Welcome back. We are so glad you're with us today. Colin Hanson is my guest on Skype. He serves as editorial director for the Gospel Coalition. He's the author of Blind Spots, Becoming a Courageous, Compassionate, and Commissioned Church, Young, Restless, Reformed, A Journalist's Journey with the New Calvinists, and co-author with John Woodbridge of A God-Sized Vision. I probably butchered that, but what the heck? You know what? Colin, good morning.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for having me.
And you're also waiting on a stork, if I have my information correct.
That is correct. Any moment now.
Yeah. And is this what number is this?
Number two. We have a son who's going to be three soon. Have a baby girl. All of for my wife and two children. All going to be Christmas birthdays.
How awesome is that?
I've already called the credit card company. My debt, my limit's been raised. I'm in good shape.
That's awesome. All right. So as we're kind of steering down the end of 2017 from the Gospel Coalition's archives, I'd be curious as to what you would discern as some of the more important theological stories of the year.
Yeah, well, you know what? I think one of the major themes this year has been related to public theology. So essentially, we've been considering, there's ecclesiology, which is about the church. There's soteriology, which is about how we're saved. Public theology is about how we bring our faith to bear on the world. And the world right now is a very confusing, very hostile in many places, very violent place. And so many of the different stories that we've seen this year have been related to how Christians bring our theology to bear on the world. Probably one of them has been related to a very popular book from this year called The Benedict Option, written by Rod Dreher. He had intended to write that expecting a Hillary Clinton presidency, which, of course, we know came as a surprise to many the end of last year that it didn't happen. And so a lot of it was about the need for Christians to be able to create communities of resistance and of integrity as the government brings a lot of pressures to bear. Well, that didn't exactly materialize in the same way, and yet the question remains, how can Christians bring our faith with integrity to bear on the challenges that we face in the world?
That was indeed a big one. I had a chance to speak to Rod about his book this year, so that was interesting. All right, what's another hot topic from the year?
Another hot topic would be, interestingly, how much does God care about small towns and rural areas? This is a fascinating one. So there's actually been a great deal of scholarly investigation about the origins of Christianity and the spread of Christianity in the Roman world. Rodney Stark and a number of other scholars have argued that Christianity was basically an urban religion. that the rural areas were pagan in the Roman Empire and resistant to the gospel, but the urban areas were more responsive. But there's actually been some more recent scholarship to reveal that it's not so, like what we read about from these various cities and Paul's missionary journeys is not exhaustive for the spread of the church in those areas, and it was not exclusively urban. So that's brought to the fore a number of questions about how that relates to our strategy today, and questions about, and just kind of trying to confront the real challenges that the church faces in rural areas with depopulation in many cases, driven by automation, a number of other different things in farm communities, or things like opioid addictions, which tend to be especially challenging in those communities. And so the church in many of these areas is really struggling, and after a lot of intense focus the last decade or two on what the church needs to be doing in urban locations, people are starting to wonder, what does this actually mean for our small towns and our rural areas as well?
Yeah, Colin, I've heard a couple of stories, and I had a pastor on that was talking about his church in some remote little town in Arkansas, I think of a population of about 400 or 500, and he gets about 2,000 people attending his church every Sunday. So there are some great stories out there of what God's doing in small towns. I know we're kind of on a top 10 list, so let's keep going.
Yeah. All right, we'll keep going. A lot of people, this is maybe the first year that they heard about the alt-right. They heard about this movement on the right of the American political and cultural spectrum, and yet does not bear a lot of resemblance necessary to earlier iterations of the right. This one having particularly a white orientation toward defending things that matter to whites as opposed to racial minorities. The Southern Baptist Convention took up this question at their annual meeting over the summer, debated this, ultimately condemned the alt-right as being anti-gospel. Then later on, probably where most people heard about this for the first time, was the march in Charlottesville related to the Confederate monuments and of course, the death that happened to one of the counter-protesters and things like that. That was a major issue that's exposed a lot of questions about kind of the theological underpinnings of the church, and especially as it relates to racial issues.
All right, this next one is of interest to all of us, of course, and that is, does anyone hear our thoughts and prayers?
Yeah, so interesting. Just a question that any of us would want to ask, but really that has to do with the aftermath of the horrific shootings that we saw this year, not only in Texas with the church, which just breaks our heart, but also in Las Vegas earlier than that at the country music concert. But the question that came back, theologically speaking, was when somebody offers, we offer our thoughts and prayers, does that mean anything? Does anything actually happen? Is there something tangible that results from that? Because in an increasingly skeptical society, that's almost seen as profane to say that. No. What you need to do is you need to offer something tangible.
Right.
Nobody cares about your thoughts and prayers, or you need to enact some kind of legislation that would change this. At least that's the big debate. And so as Christians, we push back hard and say, no, our prayers are real, tangible, effective things. God is the one who can make a difference in all of this. But like I said, an increasingly skeptical society, yeah, a lot of people are throwing that into question.
Isn't it interesting, Colin, that we would actually get to a point where people are feeling hostility towards the expression of, I will be thinking and praying for you?
It is. It's very discouraging, but it has to do with the sense that we just don't imagine a world outside of our own heads. Nothing that so essentially the most important things that happen for many people are what happen in courtrooms or what happen in legislative offices or legislative assemblies. And so the only thing they can imagine, essentially, if we have a problem, there must be some way that we can legislate this. In fact, in some ways, the reality is more hopeful because we're not putting our trust in princes. But at the same time, it's more discouraging because, you know, murder is against the law, and yet people are murdering. So it does make the question, like, how are we supposed to pass further laws more strong than murder that would somehow stop people from doing this? I'm not trying to make a statement there about gun control, but just to recognize that what we confess as Christians is that the problem of the human heart runs far deeper than I think a lot of our non-Christian neighbors would want to acknowledge.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking to Colin Hansen from the Gospel Coalition. We'll take a little break as we are going over the top theological stories of 2017. We will resume our conversation in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. I'm speaking to Colin Hanson from the Gospel Coalition. We are hashing over some of the top theological stories of 2017. And Colin, I'm curious about your take on smartphone usage. That's a big story.
Yes. Yeah. So we're 2017 was the 10-year anniversary of the iPhone. And I think we're only just beginning to understand the effects of what's come from that. Now, to be clear, my job is probably only a result of things like the smartphone. And in fact, that's how I'm speaking with you right now. So we know that there are some serious tangible benefits. I'd be lost somewhere in the middle of nowhere right now without my iPhone.
Oh, me too.
At the same time, we wonder, what kind of effect does it have when in earlier generations, if they wanted to know what was happening, they looked to the skies because they had to understand what was happening with the weather. They looked for navigation with the stars. In the later generations, they looked toward each other in the face. And now, everywhere you look, everybody's looking down at themselves, or essentially as a reflection of themselves in their smartphone. And there's a sense in which that smartphone contains their entire world. And if you don't believe how big of a revolution this is, consider the data we're beginning to pull in from the so-called Gen Z, or whatever they're calling the generation after the millennials, the first generation to grow up with smartphones. And you're seeing a lot of indication that more or less human interaction is on a serious decline, because people would rather than go out and hang out and talk with their friends and do things like that, they have everything they need right there in the palm of their hands, their smartphone.
Yeah, it's definitely changed the way we do life. I mean, I've often said, we create technology, then it turns around and recreates us.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Something we have to come to grips with theologically if we want to understand how we worship God and how that actually changes technologically.
Mm-hmm. And obviously, technology is a wonderful thing, and I love it. But like anything, it can be destructive, and you can find yourself being addicted to things that you should not be addicted to.
Absolutely. Again, we're going to need a lot of help from each other and a lot of reflection in the days to come. But thankfully, some really good books that came out in this last year to help us with that question.
All right. Let's keep going down the list. Colin, what's up next?
Well, essentially, we dealt with a number of major natural disasters, especially during hurricane season this year. The theological question that comes from this, though, is why, a little bit similar to the shootings, why was so much of the blame toward each other and not a lot of reflection on what this means about God? Let me take you back about 2004, the famous tsunami, Indian Ocean, earthquake. So many questions about theodicy, essentially questions about what does this mean about God, that he would allow things like this to happen. I didn't see as much of that this time around. And I wonder what that reflects about our culture. I saw a lot of questions about, should Houston have evacuated? A lot of questions about what does this mean about climate change or global warming? What does this mean about building in places like South Florida or with a number of different canals like they have in Houston? I saw a lot of questions about the human elements here and a lot of blame toward other people. I think that indicates a theological shift, again, kind of similar to what we've been talking about here overall.
No, I'm not.
Away from the transcendent questions, the questions of the divine, toward the questions of blame toward each other as humans.
Mm-hmm. And Colin, the sexual revolution marches on.
It does march on. The transition, I don't know, maybe you could trace this back to previous years with Caitlyn Jenner or what, but you really saw a shift here where the questions about homosexuality have receded to a certain extent. The problem hasn't gone away, or the biblical debate hasn't gone away, even though the sexual ethics have been set for thousands of years. But you really did see a shift now toward a lot of discussion about transgenderism. And that's, I think it's coming down to the very basic questions of, is there any kind of human binary, male or female, that is given to us by a creator, or gosh, if you don't even acknowledge a creator, given through us through some sort of evolutionary adaptation? Well, many advocates are suggesting that the evolutionary adaptation continues and that gender is an entirely fluid concept. Mm. In fact, in an entirely mental concept that can change from moment to moment. The big question here, and I have to say, the number one thing people come to the Gospel Coalition site and they search for is transgender. That's the number one question that people are coming and they're trying to get help for. I think it's because a lot of families, they have their kids in public schools, and the kind of popular thing to do right now around junior high or late elementary, certainly by the time of early senior high, is to consider, well, maybe I'm actually a girl. Hmm. Maybe I'm actually interested in the same sex. But really, it's not just about I'm a boy who might be attracted to other boys. No, no, no. Now it's like, I'm a boy who's attracted to other boys, but actually maybe I'm a girl. Mm. And the school systems more or less are, in many cases, we saw with President Obama's mandates previously, are encouraging this or certainly not casting a lot of doubt on that. And it's even progressed into things like sex reassignment surgeries. But the fundamental problem, just to help people to understand how to think through this, is that the weird thing is that all of the concepts of femininity and masculinity that are supposedly being upturned are actually affirmed through these questions about transgenderism. Because after all, when Caitlyn Jenner transitioned from male to female, what was happening there? He was starting to look like we expect a woman to look. So oddly enough, the binary is being reinforced in ways that actually should encourage us in the smallest ways. But at the same time, in the name of trying to erode the binary male-female at all, that contradiction, I think, gives Christians an opportunity to say, this is crazy. God made us male and female. And yes, there are some real challenges here that we need to be handled carefully and pastorally. But at the same time, we cannot and must not move away from what God created and how he created us, male and female.
Yeah, Colin, we're running a little short on time, so let's jump to the fact that this year was the Reformation's 500th anniversary.
Absolutely.
What did it highlight? What did it bring to the surface?
Really, more than anything else, it brought to the surface the need for more ongoing Reformation, not in transformation of our doctrines. Thankfully, the Reformation was itself 500 years ago, a recovery of biblical doctrine and of historic Christian doctrine. And that's what we need again in our day, not a revolution, not a transformation of our doctrines, but a return to the scriptures, a return to what we believe and why we believe it, a return to that understanding, because only in that understanding, by the power of God, does he bring revival and does he bring reformation today. In light of all these things that we've been talking about, we know that the world needs Christ, but if the church is to give the world Christ, then we must be tied to him intimately ourselves by the Spirit through the sacrifice of Jesus as revealed in his word. And so I think that is a good way to end on an encouraging word of hope.
I agree.
In this season. And it's been a major story from 2017 that I hope will continue to reverberate in years to come.
Yeah, Colin, you make my job easy. This is one of the reasons I love this job, because I get to talk to people like you. So thank you so much for your contributions, and good luck on the birth of your child coming up.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, have a great day. I've been speaking to Colin Hansen from the Gospel Coalition. What a great, great interview that was. We'll take a short break and be back in just a minute. Good morning. It's 1:30. So glad you're with us today. We're going to take a little break for news. And, you know, I had a little more time with Colin Hansen. I want you to hear that. So we'll return to that conversation with Colin Hansen from the Gospel Coalition coming up in just a few minutes. Until the top of the hour. Ann Graham Lotz, we know her as the daughter of Billy Graham. She's a radio host and author. She says repentance can lead to change first in our own lives and then ultimately in our community and world.
I believe God is wanting us to have a depth in our repentance and our relationship with him, that then we can be filled with his Spirit that that we can live for him in this last hour in such a way that we would make a difference in our culture and in our country and even in the world, and certainly in the church, for the church to be the church, to give a certain sound. You know, when the trumpet blows, if it gives an uncertain sound, nobody knows what to do. And right now, people look at the church, they have no idea what it stands for, what it is. There's so many, you know, contradictions. And wouldn't it be wonderful if the church once again was known as a place of love and compassion and healing, and a place for the gospel, where you could find hope, where you could find reconciliation with God, where you could find peace, where you could find the truth about how to get to heaven. You know, it's up to you and me, I think.
That was Ruth Graham and Graham Lotz. If you want to hear that full interview, go to myfaithradio.com. Next up, a little bit more with Colin Hansen from the Gospel Coalition, and then one of my favorite 2017 interviews, Dr. Timothy Keller. Be back in a minute.
When your team dishes out disrespect or blatantly disobeys your rules, there's conflict coming. Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. When we're in the middle of a standoff with a teen and the emotions are raging, it's hard to keep your cool. Yet despite the turmoil, conflict can actually strengthen your relationship. Here's some rules to keep in mind for having a good, healthy fight. First, focus on the big picture.
I don't have a
This
question.
Argument can serve a greater purpose. Second, try to
All
learn something about yourself instead of just lecturing your kid. So listen carefully. And third, keep the conversation two-way. In the coming year, plan in advance to have healthy arguments. You'll be surprised how everyone wins.
Strengthen your parenting muscles with Mark Gregston's free two-week boot camp called Tough Guys and Drama Queens at freeparentingcourse.com.
All right, as I continue my conversation with Colin Hansen from the Gospel Coalition, we have got a little extra time. I want to talk about a couple of other items on the list of top stories from 2017, one of which was the multi-ethnic church. Colin, do talk about that.
Well, we've been discussing for decades now how 11 a.m. is the most segregated hour on Sunday mornings in America, and how we can bring ethnic integration to our churches, not just white and black, but Asian, Latino, and otherwise. But the real question that came this year, in light of issues going on politically, we talked earlier about Charlottesville and the alt-right and those questions, but a lot of minority leaders are saying maybe actually it's time for us to give up on the multi-ethnic church. Maybe for us it's too hard, especially as African Americans, to try to explain ourselves always to white Christians who tend to be in positions of power. Maybe we need to retreat. Maybe we need to withdraw into more affirming communities where people understand us because they share our ethnic background and orientation and understanding, and often in many cases sufferings. So I have no idea how this is going to play out, but the ramifications will be pretty significant for the church in the United States.
Yeah, Colin, has racial reconciliation, has that concept worked at all?
Well, I certainly see, you know, we ran an article this year about the need to continue to use that language of racial reconciliation, because after all, reconciliation is a biblical concept. It's an explicit biblical doctrine. We are reconciled to God in Christ by the Spirit, and then we are then also reconciled to one another across ethnicities and any other ways that we're divided. But it's often proved, especially in the United States, but not only in the United States, to be more difficult than many people imagined when I first started hearing about a lot of these things in the 1990s, especially. And those are the questions. I think it's incumbent upon people like me, especially in positions of leadership who are white, to do a lot of listening, to be very patient, and to try to just listen and learn as much as we can to hear from people who are hurting.
Mm-hmm. Colin, one of the other big stories of 2017, which has been all over the news for a long time, is that the American culture has either tolerated sexual abuse or they haven't listened to the stories, but all that is changing.
Yeah, so fascinating. I think if you and I had been having this conversation on January 1st of 2017, I don't think we could have predicted this. And I guess that's part of what makes this job interesting, and it's part of what makes us have faith in God to know that He often knows best, and I think we do see it as an act of God this year, something we can be thankful for, that finally so many women who have been hurt for so long by predatory men mm-hmm. have found the courage and have found the voice and have found a willing reception to hear their cries, their pleas for justice to be done. And it's kind of a it's a different kind of justice. It's a justice that's meted out in the media and through resignations and things like that. But it's been pretty fascinating to see that, yes, we've seen, especially within Hollywood, a lot of these you know, taking down major producers and famous actors, and all sorts of secrets are being uncovered there. And it's been very difficult. You never know from day to day who's going to be the next one to be fired. It's a distressing thing in so many ways, but I think in general there is a lot of positive to that, certainly.
I mean, Colin, when you open up your favorite web browser, it's like Wheel of Fortune. What's going to show up? Who's going to be next?
It's true.
It's interesting, and it's almost disturbing. You really don't know who's next, do you?
You know, I asked some of my female friends the other day, like, are you surprised by this? Because I said, I'm surprised by this. I haven't been in many situations where I've seen that kind of predatory environment, which I guess is something that I can be thankful for. And one of them said, hey, actually, I am surprised. And the other said, no, I'm not. And I think that speaks to our different experiences, that in some ways we know that women have always been vulnerable, because not typically as strong, and just the way sex works, the consequences that are born of that for women that have not been born by men in those situations. And so it's a perennial problem. And it appears that our culture, in throwing off the restraints of biblical morality, has gotten worse with this. And I think it's an opportunity for Christians to reach into our scriptures, to reach out to our God, and to remember that we've been given all the resources we have to be able to lift up and to treasure and to love the most vulnerable among us. And especially, I think, for those of us as men, it's a call for us to act truly like men and to care for others and to put our lives on the line in defense of others, not to put them underneath the power of our pressure to try to contort them to violate their own conscience and biblical morality to be able to suit our whims. But I would love to see that kind of movement emerge to 2018. That would be to the glory of God.
If I could have said that as well as you, I'd be a writer at the Gospel Coalition. I'm just thinking.
I appreciate that.
Just thinking. Colin Hanson, thank you so much for being on the show. I just love your input, and look forward to our next conversation.
Oh, thanks so much.
Yep. Have a great day. We'll take a short break and be back with more in just a minute. As I look at Proverbs, and I love Proverbs, I remember one of your sermons has really been etched in my brain. And I always thought, you know, in a world of 7 billion people, we don't need another opinion. We need God's word. And in one of your sermons, yeah, you quickly put three passages together. Proverbs 18:2, a fool delights in airing his own opinions. Proverbs 15:5, a fool hates correction. And Proverbs 12:15, the fool thinks he's right all the time. I keep that kind of wedged in my brain every day when I get up.
We don't actually have a good category. The word fool in English for us today is just an insult. It's the same as you idiot, you moron, but in the Bible, a fool is a person who is destructively self-centered.
Mm.
In some ways, it's a category between a regular sinner and an evil person. There are people who are utterly given to evil. They know what they're doing. They really wreak terrible tragic havoc on the world. And there's most people who are regular sinners. They're flawed. They do bad. A fool is someone who is wise in his own eyes, very deeply self-centered, and completely deluded about it. Doesn't know what everybody's upset about. Sort of thinks everybody else is an idiot but him. And as a result, wreaks tremendous havoc on family, colleagues, that sort of thing. Yeah, one of the main things you get from the Proverbs that you really don't get almost anywhere else in the Bible is a deep dive on this idea of the fool. Anyone reading the book, I hope, will see foolishness in them. and so they can move away from it so they don't become a full-blown fool.
Yeah.
But it also explains an awful lot of what's going on in the world today, because a lot of times fools, because they're wise in their own eyes, actually do well in business and politics. And don't ask me to elaborate.
Another favorite proverb, Tim, is 19:3 that says, "A man's own foolish acts destroy his life, but his heart is angry with the Lord." I think I see that quite a bit in life. There, people blow up their own life, and then they're really mad at God.
Yeah, and that's part of the foolishness because, like, for example, if you look at David and you look at Saul in the Bible, they both actually screwed up very badly. They did some terrible things. But what happens with David is he repents. And what happens with Saul is he just gets more angry at everybody. That's the difference, is the fool just doesn't, is always wise in his own eyes. And even when he does blow up his life, he just gets angry at God and the world.
Mm-hmm. When I think of the passage in 27:17, iron sharpens iron, so a man sharpens the countenance of his friend. When I think of the iron sharpening iron, do you see sparks and things flying, or what do you see? What's the image you have in your mind?
Yeah, I think that's right. That's what it's actually saying is it is a kind of constructive conflict. Better, another way to put it is it's the critique of an ally. When you know someone's really for you, I think that's the key. It's, you know, this person is really for you, and then they turn and they say, "There's some things about you you've just got to change." Boy, that changes me in a way that nothing else does. Criticism from a person who clearly has a sort of ill will, doesn't really like me, finds me irritating, I tend to write that off.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe in some cases I should, but in many cases I probably shouldn't. But, you know, you tend to say, consider the source, which, by the way, it doesn't always work. Remember Balaam's ass. It was an ass, but it did prophesy. and yet what we tend to do is we say, well, because that person's not for me, I don't have to listen to them. An ally is someone who really is for you, and then when they criticize you, boy, that can really go deep and change you for good. And that's the idea, is the sparks fly, but it's the way in which you get sharp.
Tim, what about the proverb, "A soft answer turneth away wrath, but grievous words stir up anger"? I mean, it seems that words we use lovingly today can come across as grievous in our culture.
Well, that's true. By the way, don't forget, one of the things you got to remember about Proverbs is that the Proverbs are not, no one proverb is a standalone command or a promise.
Mm-hmm.
We know that because early on in Proverbs, it'll say, if you work hard, you won't be poor. And then there are other proverbs that talk about the poor working hard, but injustice sweeps away what's in their field and that kind of thing. And so at first it looks a little bit like, oh, wait a minute, these seem like contradictions. Well, only if you look at every proverb as an absolute promise. When you piece together everything the proverb says about a subject, you see it, what it's really telling you is that in general, hard work pays off. And in general, a soft answer turns away wrath. Because every proverb is actually an observation about how life works, not a standalone promise or command. But you'd be foolish to think that a soft answer, when someone criticizes you, if for you to say things graciously, you'd be wrong to not believe that generally gracious speech, people are more able to hear it. Gracious and respectful and courteous speech, even in response to an angry person. If you instead of responding with anger, you say, well, okay, well, wait a minute, I agree with you, honestly. In fact, I really do, I'm very sorry you're unhappy. In other words, if instead of yelling at the person, you respond in a soft way, in general, that usually defuses things.
Mm-hmm.
But you're absolutely right, not always. In this culture, I've never really seen it. In my life, I've never seen more anger in public discourse. And people just despise soft answers in many cases. In fact, the Internet actually rewards people who give outrageous answers.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's clickbait.
Yes.
Basically, the more angry you are and the more outrageous you are, the more your tweet or your statement is going to go all viral.
Mm-hmm.
And so, actually, the Internet actually rewards foolishness. I hate to say it, but you're right that it's. But it doesn't mean that it's still not true that in general, haters are hated and lovers are loved. In general. You know, gossips are gossiped about, and respectful people are respected. That's in general still true.
Mm-hmm. Tim, do you think that the Internet and the way in which we pursue information right now has sort of eroded some of our spiritual disciplines because of its distraction value?
Yes. In fact, I don't need to elaborate much on that, and that is absolutely true. And in some ways, social media is kind of meditation. That is, you're pondering, you're looking. I mean, it's what you should be doing with the Bible.
Yeah.
What you should be doing with the Bible and good spirit and good Christian books is spending time reading and thinking about them, and every time you have a spare minute, picking it up and reading. I mean, that's one advantage to the electronic world is like you've got your Kindle with you, or you've got your reading device, and you actually can have, I can read 5 or 6 books at a time, which is the way I like to read. Mm-hmm. I don't like to read one book through. I like to kind of work on more than one book, and I love the fact that I can have that with me. But the danger, of course, is instead of actually reading, and there's plenty of opportunity in a day to read, you go online and see what people are yelling at about. And that what it does is it just sucks up your solitude time. Yes, it does.
I'm afraid that's so true as well, that you can be so easily distracted because the response you can get online seems to fire some kind of dopamine, which you can be attracted to. When if you get into the Proverbs and just meditate on some of the Proverbs, and I know that the book of Proverbs is not a simple step to a happy life. And I appreciate it because sometimes Christians take a specific proverb or verse and they run with it and they have blinders on. And that's not a good way to go about it, is it?
No. And by the way, somebody has called Proverbs the hard candy of the Bible. And hard candy is you actually can't bite down on hard candy. You'll break a tooth or you have to suck on the candy until it goes, it gets smaller and smaller. And very often you'll find that, chocolate center or something in the very middle. That's a good image.
It's a great image.
And I found that Kathy and I wrote, we wrote a devotional on the book of Psalms a couple years ago. And as great as the Psalms are, we thought, okay, we just did this 2 years ago, so we know how much time it'll take to write a devotional on Proverbs. It took 3 times more.
Oh, wow.
3 times more time. And the reason was because the meaning of the Proverbs, and you're talking about one at a time, the meaning of the Proverbs just do not immediately, they look simpler than they are.
Mm-hmm.
Proverb might say, the wicked flee, but those with integrity do this. And you realize, wait a minute, what the wickedness is being defined here as dishonesty, because the opposite of wickedness is integrity. And so it's actually talking about not just wickedness in general, but dishonesty. And so you think about it, and then it begins to open up. And it just took so long. So I'm trying to help people in the devotional. Kathy and I are trying to give you the fruit of our meditation and try to help you move through it faster than we did.
Yeah, and you, Tim, you talk about putting up the guardrails of love and truth so people don't go off the highway, which I've always appreciated, because I read a proverb like, open rebuke is better than hidden love, and you can certainly take that to a bad place, can't you?
Yeah, but then you have soft answer. I mean, and you even have timing. So, for example, it talks about how your neighbor is not going to welcome a loud voice early in the morning. And it's basically your words have to be, here's what Proverbs would tell you. Your words have to be honest, few, apt, and calm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Honest, few, apt, and calm. So you can have an honest word, but it's not apt in the sense of it's not crafted well for the person and it's not at the right time.
Mm-hmm.
Or it could be honest and apt, but actually too wordy. You talk and talk and people don't hear you because you actually talk too long.
Yeah.
Or you're not calm. You're not careful and you're too agitated. And when you see all the things, it's not enough just to be true. And a lot of people say, well, I told them the truth. But if you told them the truth in the way most likely to not be heard, then it is your fault.
Mm-hmm. Tim, thank you so much for being a guest. I know you got a busy day of interviews. Blessings on you and Kathy and your kids and grandkids.
Thank you.
Yeah, have a great day.
You too.
Yep. Dr. Timothy Keller, his book, God's Wisdom for Navigating Life. We'll take a short break and be back in just a minute. Thank you to Logan for running the board this morning, and a special thanks to Rebecca and Paul for all their hard work on the morning show. For the management and leadership here at Faith Radio, Dick and my faithful listener Jane, Jason, Dr. Curitan, and all the University of Minnesota folks, and to all my guests and to all my listeners. Thank you so much for listening to the Early Morning Late Show. I love you all. I wish you all a very happy new year. I'm going to try to make some couscous this weekend. Not that I really like couscous, but it's fun to say. See you next year.
Early Morning Late Show.
Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.